Well, good morning, everyone. Our last time doing this here. Applause, yes, and a little like, I've kind of gotten to like it. It's just nice in a certain way. It's different. It's fun. I think we're going to like what we see in there. I know you've heard it like 15 times, but I'm going to go ahead and remind you one more time. Next week is different. Come, all the ABFs are meeting at the 9 o'clock hour. So this hour right now, normally you will not come into worship. You will go to your ABF. All the ABFs, all the Sunday school classes, all the groups are meeting at 9 o'clock. And then we're going to gather back in here. Now, I want to just give a little heads up. It will not look like this. Everything will be out. It'll just look like the regular gym. We'll have some chairs around for people who have difficulty standing because we're just going to gather for a few minutes, and we're going to ask you to stand in here when you come next week at 10:30. And we're going to start in here. We're going to have a little bit of an introduction of some key people, and then we're going to all move together to the foyer, and we're going to have a little ceremony there to open up the new auditorium, and then we're all going to go in and have our time of worship together. So just have that in mind, that next week things will be just a little bit different, and we're going to have a, you know, you get to watch them like cut the ribbon, and then we're going to have the mad stampede like Black Friday. We're not going to do that. We're going to have a very orderly approach to how we do this. And so come next week. But remember, 9 o'clock this hour, you're in your ABFs, you're in your classes, your adult fellowship groups, and then at 10:30 we'll go in and we'll have our new facility, our new auditorium completed. It's one of those things that, you know, it. I have to tell you, I've been through there this week, and you know, it kind of is, it's kind of like everything is going to be the same, only everything's going to be different, you know? The room is the same room, but it's all different, and the seats are going to be kind of in the same place, but they're all going to be different. And the platform is going to still be where the platform was, but the platform's all different. I'm laughing because we've rebuilt almost everything in there. We rebuilt the substructure of the balcony. We put in all new wiring. We've got all kinds of LED things. There's everything new in the background as far as the electronics are concerned and the lights are concerned. And everything's brand new. And I stood there and went, and it's kind of the same. So, you know, I just am getting you ready that it's going to be, I think, a very exciting time, but it's also going to be a very familiar time. I think you're going to see that things are not radical. They're still comfortable. They're still the church we've always been, and yet everything's been freshened and dressed up and new, and I trust that we're ready to serve Christ for, you know, another 40 years in that room or whatever the Lord brings our way. Today, as I thought about what we're doing, I realized that we're kind of at a break point. We finished in the Belief as Big as Life study, the piece about what we were calling the church and our worship together and our time together and what it means to serve Him and then to bear fruit in that service. And we have just a couple of points left on that. We have a point to talk us a little bit about our enemy, the adversary, and what we as a church believe about the spiritual warfare we're in. And then we have a little bit to talk about in our anticipation of Christ coming back. Those are the two pieces of the Belief as Big as Life discussion that we still have to complete as we go over the core values that we as a church hold to and that we use to shape us and our understanding of God and our ministries and all that goes with that. And I didn't want to start into a new piece of that and then have to break again for the special service next week. And we've got a great service. The kids' choir is going to be singing, and the band and orchestra have some special things planned. And we're going to have an introduction to the people who've done a lot of the work. And I think it'll be a great time of worship together and seeing how the new facility functions. And so there'll be some neat things next week. But I just didn't want to get in that start again, stop again, start again, stop again thing. So I realized we had a little time here. And I wanted to just share some thoughts from my heart that have been stirred because of a conversation that I had with my cousins while I was out visiting them a week ago. If you have your Bibles, I'd ask you to open to the book of Mark. The book of Mark, and we're going to be looking actually at Mark chapter 4. We're going to look a little bit the whole beginning of the book of Mark. But I talked last week about some of the fun stuff. You know, going out and my cousins who, for some of you who know the story, I know you've heard my life history over the years I've been here teaching, and most of you probably know my whole life history. But for those who don't, my mom's family lived out in Southern California, and my grandfather actually owned a chicken ranch. You know, when you think about the Southern California lifestyle, in a lot of ways, my grandfather was not what you think of at all. If you really knew Southern California back in the 60s and the 70s, you'd realize there were more like him than you might anticipate. But he actually had a farm. He was a farmer at heart. And he had a grain mill, and my uncles used to work the grain mill, and then they had, at one point, 100,000 chickens. And they provided eggs for that part of the Los Angeles basin up there and along the foothills there. And so it was very, it wasn't the live at the beach and live in the mountains lifestyle that we often think of. It was actually live on the farm kind of lifestyle. And so I told you a little bit about the fact that my cousins still have a little orchard in their backyard and the fresh avocado trees and the fresh orange trees and the fresh lemon trees and all that goes with that. And that's all the fun stuff. And I know sometimes those of us living here in the Midwest in February and March, we tend to think, oh, if only I could be in, you know, Florida or California or Arizona or someplace warm and sunny and not here. And we think about the weather and we think about the outdoor lifestyle and the opportunities, but that's not what we were there to do. I wasn't on vacation. We were actually out there, and my one aunt, my mother's brother's wife, is now 88, moving into a facility because she can't be in a position where she can live on her own anymore. And that happened in October. And I went out to see Aunt Betty and how the transition was going. And while we were there, actually just a week before we were there, she fell and she shattered her knee. And so she had just had surgery on her knee. And we're doing all of that with my aunt. And my cousin's mother-in-law is 90, living in the same facility. And we're meeting with them and what's going on there. And not to put any, you know, real difficult details on it, but my cousin, who is a couple years older than me, and some of you know what I am, so it's that six number plus something else at the end of it, and you're thinking your life is going to be very different than it is at that point. They've had struggles with a daughter, an adopted daughter. My I guess it's a second cousin at that point, my cousin's daughter, her youngest, has gone through some challenges, very serious ones. As happens sometimes in life. And my second cousin, Sarah, has struggled with drugs and addictions and things that happen, and that lifestyle was very tempting to her, and she got into it. And along the way, she has had a 13-year-old and a 7-year-old, and at Christmas, a now 7-week-old. And that 7-week-old was affected by the drugs that my second cousin has been involved in, and so suddenly at 66, my cousin has a 13-year-old who she's adopted, and a 7-year-old who she's caring for, and a 6-week-old that she's challenged of what to do with. And she looks at me and she says, "Dave, I can't do high school when I'm 85. What am I going to do?" And as I was out there with my cousin and my family, we spent a lot of time not out enjoying Southern California lifestyle. We went out and we prayed and we cried and we struggled and we went to rehab meetings and we went to court appearances and we stopped for supervised visitations and we did a lot of hard life stuff. I'm not telling you anything that my cousin doesn't share in her own church, and fortunately she has a great church and she has a great support group around her, and we appreciate all of that. And I tell you these things because I think sometimes we come to church, and you heard Robert this morning, you know, the technology hasn't gone well. We took out all the lighting trees and things we had because we had to move all those lights. We'd purchased those lights we were using for the last several weeks into the new facility because we had to get them installed and addressed and into the DMX lighting system and all ready to go so that we can have our program. So we've got these two spots back here providing light, and of course as soon as you stood up, everybody was in the light and we had the little shadow figures going on, and there were some things with the electronics that weren't going well and the technology wasn't working well, and Robert was talking about the stresses. We all have these stresses in life. We all have these challenges. And at some point in time, I know we all come to the place where we say, "Lord, my life is hard. Don't you even care? Don't you even care?" That's what the disciples said. in Matthew or in Mark chapter 4. We've got this interesting story. Pick up in verse 35. Take your copy of God's word and follow along with me if you will. It says, on that day when evening had come, Jesus said to them, let's go across to the other side. And leaving the crowd, they took him with them in the boat, just as he was. And other boats were with him. And a great windstorm arose, and the waves were breaking into the boat, so that the boat was already filling. But he, Jesus, was in the stern, asleep on the cushion. And they woke him and said to him, teacher, do you not care that we are perishing? That's the disciple saying, my life is hard right now. Don't you care, Jesus? Don't you care? And Jesus awoke, and he rebuked the storm, the wind, and the sea, and he said, I have to tell you, folks, the structure of the language here, we just don't seem to get it. You know, peace, be still. Now, in my particular translation I'm reading from here in the ESV, if you have it, at least they were consistent enough to put a couple of exclamation points there, like, you know, peace, exclamation point, be still, exclamation point. The underlying text, the underlying language is a command. Actually, it's a specific kind of command. It's a rebuke. This is not like, peace, be still. This is when you see your kids doing something and it's what they're not supposed to do, and you go, stop doing that right now! I said stop it! Stop, 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 stop! That's the intent of this peace, be still. Jesus goes, calm! Be quiet! And you can almost see the wind and the waves and the clouds kind of going, whoo, just like your kids. Yes, Mom. And they stopped what they were doing. And it goes on and it says, and the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. And Jesus said to them, why were you so afraid? Have you still no faith? And they were filled with great fear and said one to another, who is this? Who then is this that even the wind and the sea obey him? Who is this? Who indeed is Jesus? And how do we come to him when our life is hard and we're not sure he cares? I tell you this story because as we were going through that week, my cousin's husband, Scott, and Debbie went to this Bible study they have, a support group. And it's actually parents who are going through a lot of the same kind of struggles. And they shared together, and one of the teachers there in the group used this story. And his conclusion wasn't particularly tied to the exegesis of the story. It was kind of one of those, this is how I feel about the way things are going in life right now. And he said, you know, I look at this story, and I realize that the disciples should have seen Jesus sleeping and decided, if Jesus is here, we're going to be all right. If Jesus is here, we're going to be all right. What are we worried about? The storm and the wind and the waves, and it actually talks about the sea filling the boat. But they should have not been looking at the storm and not been looking at the waves and not been looking at the boat getting filled with water. They should have been looking at Jesus sleeping on the cushion. And they should have said, we're going to be all right. But they didn't. Now, the particular teacher who was running this class with my cousin there, he said, you know, sometimes we just have to remember that when life is tough, the place we want to be is in the boat with Jesus. You don't want to be anyplace else when life is tough. Life is going to be tough for everybody. But if you're in a spot where life is tough, then when life is tough, where do you want to be? You want to be in the boat with Jesus. And Scott must have said that week as we were going through things about five times if he said it once, I just have to remember, I'm in the boat with Jesus. And that sustained him. I'll be honest, I don't really quite think that's the purpose of what Mark was driving at in that text, but you know what? It's okay, because Scott was hanging on to that thought for dear life. He goes, my life is hard right now. He goes, and it's not that Jesus doesn't care. He goes, it's that right now, Jesus already knows the outcome, and he's in control of it, and all I have to do is be confident I'm in the boat with Jesus. But the challenge I think we face is, where do we get comfortable? Where do we get comfortable in the boat with Jesus when the storm is raging all around us? Because it's clear the disciples were not. And I came home with Scott's words ringing in my ear, and I thought about my own life and some of the struggles that I face, and I thought about the lives of several people who I've talked to and some of the struggles they face. I began to think to myself, how do I get comfortable in the boat with Jesus? Because I'll tell you what, I today have the same reaction that the disciples had. It's like, Jesus, my life is hard. Don't you even care? Because a lot of it's not getting any easier, you know. And that's the first thing I see about this. The first thing I see in this passage is the reality that as believers, we're not protected from the storm. Now, I say it because, let's be honest, that's what we want, isn't it? What we want is we want to come, and as Christians, we want to say, I'm protected from the storm. What you really would love to have me say as a pastor today coming in is, you know, folks, I know that there's storms going on in life right now. There's all kinds of storms that you're facing. They might be family storms. They might be health storms. They might be financial storms. They might be storms with your neighbors or storms even with your family and the relationship you're having. There's all kinds of storms going on in your life. But here's what I want to tell you. If you come to Jesus, he'll say, peace be still. The storms will all be calmed, and you won't have to face any more storms in your life. Isn't that what you want me to preach? That's what I want to preach. That'd be so fun if I could preach that. If I could preach that with confidence, there are going to be no more storms in your life once you're a believer. I hear that all the time, actually. I hear preachers who love to stand up and promise that if people will just come to Jesus, he's going to fix this problem and solve that problem. They're going to have great relationships and financial security and be successful in their jobs and healthy, wealthy, and wise and all of that. And they don't even have to get up early, like Benjamin Franklin said. All you got to do is just trust Jesus and all the storms go away. And you know what? That's just not true. The challenge is how do you trust Jesus when the storm is raging around you and the boat is filling with water? What would make you go back and lay on the cushion at the stern of the boat right where Jesus was and say, wow, this sounds like a good time for a nap. I think I'll join you. I want you to go back to the beginning of Mark for just a second. Mark is an interesting book. Mark has always been one of those books that I struggled with because it's so in your face. If you know the Gospels and you read them, Luke is the historian. Luke is probably my favorite because I'm a historian at heart. And Luke, like he loves to tell the history. We talked at Christmas time about how the opening structures of Luke are probably what I titled Mary's baby book. In all likelihood, Luke sat down when he got to know the disciples and got to know Mary, and he listened to her story and he started taking notes on it. And it's all this, you know, all the dates and the people are accurate and structured and kind of chronological in the order that things happen. And you look at Luke, it's a nice, structured, formal kind of history, and it all lays out and makes sense. And Mark's not that way. Mark is staccato in its tone and in your face. And he uses terms like immediately and right away, and things keep moving, and it just rushes. And you almost can't catch your breath if you're reading it. The stories move by so fast. Look at what happens here. In Mark chapter 1, verse 1, he starts, he goes, "This is the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God." Okay. I mean, it's like, let's just get it out here. What am I going to tell you? I'm going to tell you right from the start, word one, sentence one, Jesus is the Son of God, and I want to tell you why. That's how Mark starts his gospel. And you've got John the Baptist appearing, and then by verse 9, you've got the baptism of Jesus, and in verse 12, you've got the temptation of Jesus. Like, wow, we're already through Matthew chapter like 9, and I haven't even caught my breath yet. And in verse 14, it says, "Now, after John was arrested, Jesus came to Galilee, proclaiming the gospel of God and saying, 'The time is fulfilled and the kingdom of God is at hand. Repent and believe the gospel.'" And he calls his disciples, and right away he starts out ministering. And it says, if you got headings, I'm just going to go through some of the headings that are in my particular print. Verse 21, Jesus heals a man with the unclean spirit. Verse 29, Jesus heals many. I mean, we're not through half of chapter 1 yet. And immediately he left the synagogue and entered the house of Simon and Andrew and James and John. And Simon's mother-in-law lay ill with a fever. And immediately they told him about her. And he came and took her by the hand and lifted her up. And her fever left, and she began to serve them. And that evening at sundown, they brought to him all who were sick or oppressed by demons. And the whole city was gathered together at the door. And he healed many who were sick and various diseases and cast out many demons. And he would not permit the demons to speak. And he goes on and he preaches in Galilee and he cleanses a leper and he heals a paralytic and he calls Matthew and he has a whole confrontation with the Pharisees over what is the law and is not the law and what supports the law. And then he heals a man with a withered hand. And now we get down to halfway through verse chapter 3, and it says in verse 7, "And Jesus withdrew with his disciples to the sea, and a great crowd followed him." And here's where I want you to kind of pay attention to what Mark says as he describes this. "A great crowd followed him from Galilee and Judea and Jerusalem and Idumea." Okay, he has just covered everything from Mount Hermon all the way down to the bottom of the Red Sea. Galilee and Judea and Jerusalem and Idumea. Just take your map of Israel and start up at Mount Hermon and move all the way down to the bottom of the Red Sea. And you've covered what he's talking about. And Tyre and Sidon as well. Why Tyre and Sidon? They're up on the Mediterranean coast. He's kind of covered the whole region. Why Tyre and Sidon? Because they were the primary ports through which foreigners came in. What Mark is telling you here by chapter 3 is that the fame of Jesus had gone out so far and so wide that there were enormous crowds from everywhere in the country who are now piling in to wherever he was to see him and to touch him and to hear from him and to be healed by him. That's why I say that Mark just comes at you hard and in your face and fast. What the other writers take all kinds of time to build in their understanding of the history and the story of Jesus, Mark is just slam, 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 slam. Look at what Jesus is doing. Look at the miracles. Listen to the teaching. Look at the confrontations. And here, this great crowd follows him. "And whenever the unclean spirits saw him, they fell down before him and cried out, 'You are the Son of God.'" And he went up on a mountain, verse 13 of chapter 3. And he called to him those whom he desired, and they came to him, and he appointed 12, whom he also named apostles. He appointed 12 so that they might be with him, and he might send them out to preach and have authority to cast out demons. And it goes through and it tells who those 12 were. And then he went home, and the crowds gathered again, so they could not even eat, it says in verse 20. So Jesus is doing all this, it's all happening, and Mark's telling us about it, and he gets to this point when he says, and Jesus gathers these together. Why did he gather them together? So that they could be with him. So they could be with him. And then he could what? He could send them out to preach and to have power over evil, over the demons. And he picked his 12, and then they went home. I believe this is back to Capernaum, but they went home to eat, and they couldn't even eat because there were so many there. And when his family heard it, they went out to seize him, and they were saying he's out of his mind. And we get into the whole blasphemy thing, and who's your real mother and father? And he gets into all of that when he talks about those who do the will of God. And finally, he starts to teach the parables. And in chapter 4, we get these parables. And the big one is the parable of the sower. And he talks about the gospel. Remember, he said that these disciples were brought together, they would know him, and they would be able to go out and preach and have power over evil. And he says, let's talk about what it's like when you sow the seed. He goes, not everybody's going to respond the way you want them to. And there's hard ground, and there's thorny ground, and there's birds that fly in, and then there's good soil. And the parable, and the apostles really struggle with it. They don't really get it. And so he explains it to them. He actually, let's see, this is how it's going to work, guys. I'm going to tell these stories, and some people are going to understand the stories, and a lot of people aren't going to understand the stories, but you should understand the stories. Let me explain the stories to you. And so he explains just what the parable of the sower was all about. And then he goes on, and he talks about three more parables. He says, why do you bring a lamp into a room? So you can hide under a bushel? No, so that you can light up the room. He says, and what happens when you plant a seed? He goes, do you have to go out there and every day tend the seed? And do you have to prod it to sprout? And then do you have to shape the leaves? He goes, no. You put the seed in the ground, and he says, and you look at it, it actually says the earth by itself. It's really an interesting thing in verse 28. He goes, the earth produces by itself. First the blade, then the ear, then the full grain. And when the grain is ripe, what? Then you put the sickle to it and you reap the harvest. And then he says, with what can we compare the kingdom of God? Or what parable shall we use for it? It's like a grain of mustard seed, which when sown in the ground is the smallest of the seeds, and yet it produces a great big tree. Now, I'm not going to get into what seed it was and how big the difference is. And, you know, people have all fought about, well, what kind of seed was it? Really mustard seed? Because that's just a little bush. And what's seed? Jesus is talking about a parable here, and he's saying it doesn't take a lot of seed. It takes just a little seed. A little seed and big things happen. And with many such parables, it says in verse 33, he spoke the word to them as they were able to hear it. And he did not speak to them without a parable, but privately to his own disciples, he explained everything. Privately to his own disciples, he explained everything. And here's the picture I'm beginning to see. I'm beginning to see that all this time, Jesus has been doing these miracles and this teaching, and he's confronted the Pharisees, and he's explained and explained and explained, and finally he starts teaching in these parables, and when the disciples don't get it, he takes them aside, and he explains it to them, and he explains it to them, and he explains it to them. And on that day, when evening had come, he said, let's cross over to the other side. Now, I'm beginning to get a picture in my head. All these people from all over the world, all over Jerusalem, all the way from Mount Mount Hermon, thank you. No such thing as Mount Hebron. And my mind was going, what am I thinking? All the way from Mount Hermon up there down to the bottom of the Red Sea, and all these people coming in through the ports at Tyre and Sidon, they're all gathered around, and he goes back to Capernaum on the west side of the Sea of Galilee, and it's so crowded he can't even have dinner because everybody's pushing in and pushing in and pushing in, and he's giving them all these parables, and some are going, I don't get it. And some are going, I think I get it. And the disciples are going, can we get it? And he's taking them aside. He goes, look, I'm going to tell you what it is. And he's giving them all this information. And finally, he goes, enough, enough. He goes, let's go across to the other side. In 1986, back up one more step, the Sea of Galilee has been dropping because of the way that the water is being utilized, and there's a lot of things happening, and there's a big debate about how they're going to manage the Sea of Galilee and droughts and conditions and all this stuff. But back in 1986, the Sea of Galilee dropped to a point where there was a piece of shoreline removed, and down in the mud, they found a boat buried and preserved that we know goes back to the time of Christ. They call it the Galilee boat, or some people call it the Jesus boat. And if you go to Jerusalem, or if you go to a Galilee now, they've got it preserved. They brought it up. They did the archaeological work on it. They preserved the wood in such a way that it has now been preserved and restored. And you can go and you can see this boat, and it's very much for sure like the boat we're talking about here. They're about 26 feet long. They're kind of a little bit low. They usually had a deck on the back and a deck on the front, and open in the middle. They were manned by usually four oarsmen and had a sail, and they used them to fish, and this is all what's going on out there. It's this kind of boat. So it's not a huge boat, but it's, you know, and these are the ones. And Jesus gets in this boat, and he goes, let's get out of here. That's what you're hearing. Let's go to the other side. I've got all these thousands of people cramming around me and grabbing after me, and I've been teaching and working and healing, and I'm exhausted. And on that day when evening came, he said to them, let's cross over to the other side. And leaving the crowd, they took him with them in the boat just as he was. You know what? I've thought a lot about that and read stuff there. See, Mark's not big on a lot of the details. And yet in this particular story, he gives us more details than anybody else. He's the only one who mentions the cushion, for instance, you know. And he goes, they took him in the boat just as he was. And then they add, and there were other boats with him. You know what this is? This is the paparazzi. This is the crowds. They're just stalking Jesus. He can't get away. They literally say, just as he was, meaning don't go back to the house. Don't pack your little bag. Don't get a lunch to go with. Just as you are, you want to get out of here? Let's get in the boat and go. Come on, Jesus. And just as he was, they take him and they put him in the boat and they push off. And what happens? A whole bunch of boats going, Jesus is leaving, folks. Grab a boat. They all come down, they grab a boat, and they all take off with him. They get out in the middle of the sea, and if you know the story, Sea of Galilee is about 700 feet below sea level. Mount Hermon's about 9,000 feet above sea level. You got this huge drop off, and it all happens in the space of about less than 20 miles, and you know this big thing, and there's this kind of gap on the western side open to the Mediterranean, and the winds just blow in there, and they create literally a hurricane. The term here used for storm in Greek is a term that if you read about it in the Greek islands, in other Greek literature, it's the word they use for hurricane. And the winds sweep in, and they just, you know, swirl in that Galilean valley there. And the Sea of Galilee is actually fairly shallow, and it just creates this completely almost unlivable storm situation. And that's what apparently happened here. A great windstorm arose and the waves were breaking into the boats that the boat was already filling. But Jesus was in the stern, asleep on a cushion. And the disciples woke him and said, Teacher, don't you care that we are perishing? Is there anybody here today who would have the courage to let me know that you're not sure that you really believe? Anyone here who says, I'm not sure I'm really a Christian? I'm kind of curious, but to be honest with you, I got all kinds of questions. I'm not sure I really believe that resurrection stuff. I'm not sure I I really believe that, well, that I'm a sinner and that there's this place called hell and, you know, that I need Jesus. Anybody here that would be willing to admit that they're not sure? I'm not trying to embarrass you. I just am kind of having an honest conversation here, and I wonder if somebody would be honest enough to say, I'm not really sure. I'm not sure I'm a Christian. Okay. I didn't know. I thought I'd ask. I know this. There are days when I have doubts about what it means to be a Christian. I think I'm past the point where I truly trust Christ. I don't have that question anymore, but I probably have some doubts about what it means to be a Christian. And there are some days when I feel just like the disciples, come on, my life is hard, Jesus. Don't you care? Don't you care that I'm hurting? Don't you care that I'm struggling? Don't you care that my cousin is hurting? Don't you care that my second cousin is caught up in this thing that's just destroying her? Don't you care, Jesus? Don't you care? And then I'm reminded, Jesus didn't come to save me from the storm now. He came to prepare me to people, to preach to people who don't know him so they can be saved for eternity. And the question is, how much does it take for me to say, I'm ready? How much does it take for me to say, I'm ready? When I was 16, I was coming up on the time when I was going to hopefully go out and get my driver's license. And I'd been working since I was 14 at a store in town, and I'd been saving my little $1.10 an hour after school and weekends, paychecks, and I knew I was going to go for my driver's test in a couple of months, and I thought, wouldn't it be cool if I had a car as soon as I had my license? So I came to my mom and dad, and I said, Mom, Dad, I'm going to get my license in a few weeks. What'd you think if I bought a car? Now, just stop for a minute, all you parents in the room. I got to tell you, eyes rolled everywhere in the room simultaneously. Every parent in the room who's either been there or is afraid they're going to be there just went, oh, no. The 16-year-old comes to me and says, Mom, Dad, I'm going to get my license in a few weeks. Don't you think it'd be a great idea? Kate is just giving me eyes right now. He's like, I got you, man. He goes, I'm going to be 16 in a few weeks. He goes, wouldn't it be great if I had a car on the day I got my license? And I had to explain. I've been responsible. My grades are good in school. I needed to go back and forth to work. You wouldn't have to take me down and drop me off and send me back again. And I've got the money I've been saving for, 2 years on this. And I found this car in the, this is back in the days pre-internet. It's called, you looked in the newspaper in the for sale section. And I found this car and I can afford it. It's an old 1963 Bel Air straight six, but I can afford it. What do you think, Mom? What do you think, Dad? And finally Dad goes, hey, that's enough. You can get the car. How much convincing does God have to do for us to get it? That he is saying to us, I'm not trying to take the storms out of your life. I'm trying to prepare you to go out and save other people by preaching that you know me and you trust me. I suddenly looked at this passage and I realized it's not about just being in the boat to be safe with Jesus. It's all that previous stuff that Mark was getting at from the beginning when he says, do you know that Jesus is the Son of God? And do you know that all of this is so that he can provide his saving grace to everyone else? And when I talk about my disciples, I'm calling you so that I can send you out to preach and you can have authority over evil, so that you can change the lives of others. That's what you're here for? And he gets out there on the boat, and he's exhausted. I'm going to tell you what I think maybe Jesus was hoping would happen here. I may be wrong on this. I may be entirely wrong on this, but I'm going to just give you. I think Jesus was hoping maybe he would say, guys, have you watched what I've been doing? Do you see how tired I am? When are you going to step up and start preaching for me? Is it possible that that's just a little bit of what was happening there? I've brought you alongside so that you can go out and preach and you can have authority and you can do this job all over the world. Right now, the world's coming to me, but I'm looking to send you out to all the world. Are you ready? Are you ready? Are you ready? Because I'm beat. I'm exhausted. And they put him on the boat and they sail out and the storm comes. And the first thing they say is, don't you care that we're perishing? And he goes, don't you get it yet? Now, I'm going to go out on a limb here. This is just me. I'm just suggesting this. I want to be very clear. There's places where you know exactly what you're doing with Scripture, and there's places where you're just suggesting it. I'm just suggesting this. Maybe what Jesus really wanted was for one of them to stand up and say, God, will you calm this storm? Because we've got a job to do, and it's not going to happen if we're at the bottom of the sea. And instead of the disciples being worried about whether they were perishing or not, maybe Jesus wanted them to stand up and say, I've seen what he can do. I've seen him heal, and I've seen him command, and I've seen him preach, and I've seen him face the opposition, and he's explained to me all the parables, and I'm supposed to know what I'm doing now, and maybe it's my turn, and maybe what Jesus wanted while he was sleeping in the back of the boat is one of the disciples to stand up and say, peace, be still. Now, I don't know for sure that they would have had that authority at that time. I'm just saying, I look at this passage, and for the first time in a long time as I wrestled with it, I realized when Jesus said, oh, you little faith. It wasn't just that he was saying, don't you know that I'm here, and as long as I'm here, everything's going to be fine? I think he was saying is, don't you know that when I'm not here, everything is still going to be fine because I have given you, as my disciples, the challenge and the opportunity to go out and preach in my place and teach in my place and have power over evil in my place. I'm not trying to put this in some kind of a we have miraculous powers thing. I'm just wondering where our faith is. How many times do we have to see Jesus work before we realize that we can trust him, not just to keep us safe, but to do the mission he's prepared us to do in the face of whatever opposition comes our way? I love that my cousin felt confident that he could face the storm as long as he was in the boat with Jesus. But I'm wondering about the people who weren't in the boat with Jesus. Did they understand that they have that same power if they have been with Jesus and are his disciples? See, I've struggled a lot with the whole thing of why does he say, oh, you of little faith? I thought about it in my life. I thought, what does it take for me to be convinced? If I'm my dad and the kid is coming and making his argument, when do I say, enough, I get it, you can go buy the car? When do I say, I get it, enough, I got the argument? I thought in my life of just a few of the times when I've seen God work miraculously. I was in a car accident in seminary, and it wasn't just that I got hit by three different cars simultaneously on the freeway, and my car was literally crunched on three sides. It's that I walked away from it with nothing but a bruise. And if that's not enough, the car that got totaled was the car that when we went to seminary, I said in a prayer with Wendy, I said, we don't have money for a car. This old puppy's got to get us through at least all 4 years. And you know what? That old puppy got us through all 4 years. And on the week after I graduated, I was in an accident that completely totaled the car, left me fine, and gave us a check from the insurance company to go out and guess what? Buy a brand new car. You say, really? Yeah. Do you know that I got $100 less for that car in the insurance settlement than I had paid for it 5 years earlier? You don't think that's a miracle? It got me through seminary. That set me up for what's next. Now you say, it's just coincidence. Maybe. But I saw God work and I saw God bless. I will tell you that when this Volkswagen came across the median at full speed, and I saw it in my windshield coming at me, I literally said, so this is how you die. And bang, it hits me in the front, and it slams me into the car behind me, and it spins me around, and another car hits me on the side, and I'm sitting there going, why am I not dead? Some of you know the story of my daughter and the accident she had and the fear we had that she was gone, that God had taken her. And I had to wrestle with the reality as a parent whether I could let her go. And then God restored her and gave her amnesia for 7 days. It's still the funniest thing in the world to us. 7 days in the hospital from the time of her head injury until the time she went home that she does not remember at all. And as a result, she has no fear because she doesn't remember the accident. She doesn't remember it at all. You know what's more amazing? Is the three compressed vertebrae, the three broken vertebrae in her back, because of another accident she had now at 30, from when she was 16, they did an MRI in her back again, and you know what? Two of them have almost completely restored, and one of them has just a little bit of a compression on it. And you're going, what? I thought we lost her. And she's restored. But it's not just those kind of things. I thought about the time when I was called upon to preach in a situation and I hadn't prepared at all and I didn't even hardly know what I was going to say. And I got up and I started quoting verses I'm not sure I'd ever memorized. And God put words in my mouth and I had a chance to share things and you go, this is amazing. Or I've thought about the times when someone's come into my office and I'm totally unprepared and they unload a really deep hurt or burden and you go, I'm not prepared or equipped to deal with this. And then God brings you words and you share them. And people are encouraged or strengthened where they find hope. And you walk, they walk out of your office and you go, that wasn't me. Where did that come from? I wasn't ready for that. You say, God's working in my life. And I thought about the times when I faced real temptation and God has intervened. I'm as human is the next guy. There have been times when I could have gone down any one of a number of paths. I've had girls make open propositions to me. I've been in situations where there was money available and I could have just taken it. I've had opportunities to lie, to make myself look better or enhance my opportunities. Why didn't I do it? Why didn't I take them? I wanted to. No, let's be honest. I'm human. And you go, and then something stops you. And you say, God just protected me. God didn't let me go down that path. And here's my point. How many times do I have to see God work in my life before I say, I get it, God? You're not trying to protect me from the storms. You're trying to show me that you're with me so that I can go out and be the disciple and the witness you have called and prepared me to be. Because we've got a lost world. And they need to hear who you are, not just from this book, but from my life. And the reason I wanted to ask if there's anybody here who isn't sure there are Christians, because I want to say this to you. I understand the doubt and I understand the fear. And maybe you can't see it in a book that's 2,000 years old and stories about disciples. So let me just tell you, it's real for me too. Jesus has been in my life and he has shaped me and he has protected me and he has empowered me and he has given me the opportunity to come to you and tell you this simple truth. He is, as Mark says at the beginning of his gospel, the Son of God. And he loves you. And he wants to save you. And if you've never trusted him before, hear my story and trust him now. Hear my story and trust him now. And for the rest of us who know Christ, let's stop looking for him to calm the storms in our life. Let's stand up and exert the power he has given us. And ask God to remove the storms, not so that we can be comfortable, so that we can be effective in ministering to those as his disciples who he has called us to preach and to hold authority over evil in their lives so that they can be redeemed. I think that's the real power of Jesus asleep in the boat. He wants us to stand up when he's gone and do the work that he's prepared us to do. Father, thank you so much for this amazing story. Thank you for Scott and Debbie. Just be with them out there. Lord, touch Sarah. Call her back from this place of darkness that she's in. Lord, help each of us to hear this story and yes, be thankful that we're in the boat with you and we know that you can calm the sea. But Lord, more than that, help us see that when you are not right there, that you are preparing your disciples for a day when you would be gone, that you are preparing us for a time now when you have let us be your witnesses to the world. Lord, let us see in our lives all the places where you have demonstrated who you are so that we have been with you and we can now go out and preach and we can have authority over evil and we can share your amazing hope with the world who truly are caught not just in the storm, but in the very grip of our enemy. And let us redeem them for eternity. And we ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.